Good afternoon. This is the matter of In Re Wade v. Robertson, 9th Circuit Docket 680177. This is a hearing requested by Mr. Robertson in response to the court's order to show cause why Mr. Robertson should not be disbarred in the 9th Circuit based on his disbarment in the state of California. Mr. Robertson, why did you come up to the lectern? We are recording these proceedings, so in the event that you need any record, what will be available to you by video or audio? I'm going to have some questions for you, so at this time I would like the courtroom deputy to administer the oath so that all your statements are under penalty of perjury. Mr. Robertson, I've received your submissions in response to the order to show cause, including the declaration that came in a day or so ago. Speak to Juanita. It's evident to you understand the scope of this proceeding. Concerns your ability to practice in the 9th Circuit, and I think that we do affects California's determination. And you're aware, because you cited it, the limited scope of review in these cases, where our court reviews the determination of the California bar proceedings, and we basically look at whether there was a notice and an opportunity to be heard appropriate to process whether the proof of facts was sufficient to support the disciplinary action taken, or whether there's some other grave reason that would prevent this court from respecting the decision of the California Supreme Court, essentially saying that we would impose a reciprocal disbarment on you. So, I've read your submissions, and I think I understand your position. I have a few questions I want to ask you that will illuminate, I think, some of the issues for me. But this is your hearing under the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. You're entitled to the hearing. And I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to make your points with the proviso that I've read the materials that you've sent in, so I don't want you to feel compelled to reiterate points that you've made in writing, but I also, we're here in this hearing to have some discourse, so if you have particular points you want to emphasize, fine, and I want to ask you some questions too, so if you want to know what's in my mind, I'm happy to oblige. So how do you propose to proceed in this time?
Thank you, Commissioner, for the opportunity to come in here today and also to respond to the court's order to show cause for the materials. I have one factual matter of record that might be helpful, and I just put it on the top of my notebook to make sure I mention to you as a staff attorney that might be helpful. As you parse the record now,
Please, you know, bring that microphone a little closer. This room is so beautiful and small, the acoustics are not great. So even with microphone resistance, it's difficult to hear you.
Well, can you hear me?
Is that better? Yes,
okay, thank you. But as your whatever you would prefer, if you would like to lead with your questions, or if you allow me to present first, whatever purpose you have.
Why don't I ask you my questions then? We'll make sure that you get them addressed, and then that'll give you some inkling of my thinking or my questions or concerns, and then you can set first preliminary matter, you identified some of the other jurisdictions that are currently in the process of also doing reciprocal proceedings. And so I was curious as to whether any of those reciprocal proceedings have been completed.
No, sir, they have not. I have filed a response to an order to show cause, which in the District of Columbia, to the Court of Appeals, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which is the governing court, has exclusive jurisdictions over attorneys admitted to that jurisdiction. I am about to file a reply to a statement from Bar Counsel on that, and at some point, there'll be some actions are taken. I'm not going to gain what I'm not going to forecast what I think is going to happen, but I have, in many respects, told the District of Columbia Court of Appeals what I've told the Ninth Circuit. So, it'll be interesting to see what happens. The Northern District of California has an interim suspension that I contested that dates back to the time in which the State Bar put me on involuntary inactive status. And you may remember, I don't recall if it was you specifically that signed the order, but I had contested at some point, you know, before there was a final order from the California Supreme Court that was premature. And I had told Judge Alsup, Honorable Judge Alsup in the district court, that the involuntary inactive status that it was placed on was not pursuant to California state law, controlling law, the Supreme Court of California was actually not disciplined, not yet. But they still put me on interim suspension, and their rules are a little bit murky. You know, at the time, it just wasn't worth fighting it. I just said fine. Because one of the prerequisites for active membership in the Northern District is you actually have to be an active member of California. So it's whether it's going to go down the road of discipline or the fact that I'm no longer active, it's fine. And then the Southern District of California had done the same thing, but their my understanding, I haven't seen looked at the order recently, but my understanding was that it was stayed there, but I was in an interim suspension. And I would eventually come back to them, as I have done with you. Now, the Northern District of California proceedings, I made it aware through numerous status reports that I intend to contest the imposition of discipline there based upon the same factors that were the analogous factors that this court uses, for instance, the selling factors and the Kramer factors. The Northern District has its own local rules, but I'll be presenting the same evidence. I'm not sure if that's going to be Judge Donato. I brought to Judge Donato's attention that he has a conflict of interest, and he probably needs to recuse himself. So, Sponte, he hasn't responded yet, but we'll see what happens. Thank you.
So my first question is directed to your contention about the extraterritorial effect of the California State Bar proceedings and their considering actions that occurred in the District of Columbia as the basis for their taking action against you. And so I guess my question is, if these proceedings had been criminal in nature, convicted in the District of Columbia of doing the acts that shall we say necessitate a finding of moral turpitude. Is it your position that the State of California could not consider those acts in determining whether it penetrates with the practice in California?
No, that's not my position. May I elicit my position?
Excuse me?
I'd like to elicit my position off, if you don't mind.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to understand what the distinction would be in your mind from that determination and the determination of other acts that may not be criminal but civil acts that would call into question that attorney's fitness to practice.
So, just to be clear, and I made a note on this because I was going to raise this to the court, I'm not challenging the general jurisdiction of the California Supreme Court to, with respect to attorney discipline over any of its attorney members. So if the California Supreme Court has a rule, or if there is a particular statute that's been passed, or even if it by its own inherent power it has ability to refer things back and forth. But these are very different mechanisms. If it wants to call one of its own bar members out on the carpet and, you know, conduct some proceedings about his moral, you know, acts of potential moral turpitude, or the fact that a member may have been convicted of a crime in a foreign jurisdiction, it has that authority to do so. So that's not the issue. I don't doubt that the California Supreme Court has authority to discipline its members. But I want to, you know, remind the court that what happened here, if all of this happened in the state bar of California, the Supreme Court denied my petition for review. In fact, it hasn't granted a single petition for review in over 15 years. So it took the recommendation of the California Bar and simply adopted it. What happened in these proceedings was the State Bar of California, which is an administrative agency, it's a public corporation, it decided to prosecute me through administrative procedures based upon the violation of the California State Statute or the California Business Efficiency Code, specifically 6106. It's never done this before in the history of the bar. Never, never. There's no history of the California State Bar trying to discipline an attorney in another jurisdiction based upon what they did for violating 6106. Now, you ask this in a movie about criminal convictions and things like that. There actually is, per the State Bar Act, set up specifically to deal with criminal convictions. And those would apply. Now, those would appear to have some extraordinary application, but, you know, That's a different animal than what we're dealing with here.
Why is it different?
Because there was no criminal conviction.
No, but if California, if the state of California has authority to discipline a bar member for a criminal act occurring outside its jurisdiction, why is it not also entitled to discipline an attorney based on an act of moral turpitude that's not criminal?
Sure. There's three cases that I did not specifically mention in my brief because I looked at them and I thought about mentioning them and I thought, well, you know, I've made the point that they're not opposite because never in the history of California bar has California attempted to reach outside its geographic boundaries the way it is here.
And those are really, the fact that it has never done it in the past doesn't really speak one way or another to whether it has power to do it.
Okay.
And your position is that it doesn't, and I'm trying to figure out why it doesn't. But let's assume for purposes of argument that this is unprecedented, and why can't they do that? Why can't they conclude that an attorney who acts improperly in actions outside the state being deemed unfit to practice inside the state?
So, in this particular instance, what makes it even more unusual, more egregious, in my arguments, more egregious, is that I was separately licensed in the District of Columbia still am. So, District of Columbia took a look at this, and all these acts occurred in the District of Columbia in that jurisdiction. And there's, you know, California, there's the District of Columbia law that says that the District of Columbia has exclusive jurisdiction to discipline, to admit and discipline attorneys within this geographic bounds. So the state of California did not like the fact that the District of Columbia Bar had not taken any action. And Mr. Carrera's attorney stood behind the scenes and had been lobbying the bars, and as the evidence eventually came out, you know, back to the bar proceedings, there started the formal proceedings. You know, they'd been doing so because they were asking for money, for monetary reimbursement. So at some point, so the administration of the California Bar, right?
You're raising facts and issues I'm not familiar with, so before I forget to ask you to explain the background, okay, is there evidence in the record that a complaint was made to the District of Columbia governing body for discipline, and that they affirmatively chose not to prosecute for attorney discipline?
When I, after the proceedings began in December of 2012 here in California, between the initiation of
the...
Yes.
The proceedings are began before that, but 2012 is when the review department is in its decision.
No, that's what
my
it was summer of 2012 that the charges were filed, the formal charges, and so there was the commencement of at that point, I received, there was a process where I request discovery, and so I found out that that the request of discovery, there had been an email exchange between California bar prosecutors and D.C. bar prosecutors. The California bar prosecutors said, well, you know, are you going to do anything? And the D.C. bar prosecutor said, well, you know, not at this time, maybe later. And so that wasn't good enough. That wasn't the answer the California bar prosecutors wanted to hear. So instead, they just went ahead and filed charges anyway.
Where is that in the record? The exchange of correspondence between California and the D.C. bar?
It would be one of my trial and record exhibits that was admitted. The question in my mind is whether or not I provided that in the appendix of record excerpts. But it is one of the volume three, I provided some of the state bar exhibits. I actually submitted it to the hearing department as an exhibit after it was provided to me in discovery. All right, so this, I do not believe I included it specifically as an exhibit in my appendix of record excerpts, but it is part of the official record.
So, getting back to the question that I asked you. So let's see and say that the District of Columbia decided, well, for our broad purposes, we're not going to take action. Okay, so California says, well, District of Columbia, separate sovereign, they can do whatever they want. We think that this is worth pursuing. So why is California entitled to be there?
Okay, so I laid out my arguments, which I'm going to make the assumption you've read them, that my own regurgitate, when I laid out my arguments, has to do with the law, the federal law says. And at the outset, let me say this, no, there's a notice problem. Because if I'm not told in advance, if there's no notice that California, the California Bar, could use a state statute passed by the legislature, not a rule from the California Supreme Court, but a state statute passed by the California legislature, that has no explicit extraterritorial effect, and has never been applied in this manner. If they could use this to punish me as an attorney for something that I did in Washington, D.C., not just Washington, D.C., but something I did in another jurisdiction where I'm licensed in practicing law, then where is the notice beforehand that's required to hold me accountable? Well, this goes to
the statute. The statute says that it says California can do that, and I'm still trying to figure out why California wasn't entitled to do that. Leaving aside, notice is a little bit of a different issue that you've raised. We'll get to that in a minute. I'm not asking about whether in the absence of notice it would be okay to do that. I'm just asking whether California, assuming all other things are okay, whether what prevents California from imposing in its own bar regulation process acts that occur outside of California. You've already conceded that they can do so with a criminal action. I'm just trying to figure out what the analytic backdrop is for saying California can't consider matters that occur outside of California and determine defendants of its attorneys to practice.
Okay, so that's not precisely what I'm saying. So let me be clear. What I'm saying is, I'm not saying that California, it's not the bar, it's the Supreme Court of California. They're the only ones that have plenary jurisdiction. So I'm not saying that the California Supreme Court does not have jurisdiction to call me out and disbar me based upon some sort of process, some sort of show clause that it wants to do, but it has to. If it's going to have rules, it's going to tell us in advance of what we can't do, whether it's through the rules of procedure, excuse me, the rules of professional conduct that the Supreme Court signs off on for California attorneys, or it's through the exercise of state bar act violations that the California bar processes. Either way, you've got notice in advance. Now, in terms of the extraterritorial reach, the problem is if you look at the result that I'm in now. So, California has made a decision to punish me, to call me out and make me defend myself based upon charges for events that occurred in Washington, D.C. Okay. So, they've reached their own conclusion. Now, in Washington, D.C., I have to go, but I'm actually not entitled to the full monopoly of protections that would have been afforded otherwise had that adjudication, had District Columbia laws and adjudication of those of what had happened occurred in District Columbia. Now, I'm actually suffering because District Columbia, I'm only entitled to argue against the imposition of reciprocal discipline, and yet it was District of Columbia that had original jurisdiction all along, and this is exactly what the Supreme Court has tried to make. I've listed a number of cases here, a number of arguments about the problems you get into with the extraterritorial reach of state laws, the problems with the Commerce Clause, the idea that California can regulate its own attorneys, great. If you do something the state of California tells you not to do, that's great as well. There's this gray area about these, what happens in your federal conviction, this, that, and the other, but you know what? I don't think it's been challenged, but whether or not it would ever be challenged, the fact is they actually have a statute on the books that says this will happen. Okay? That's not this case.
So, what I'm guessing this argument is you're telling me that if you hadn't been a member of the District of Columbia Bar, or if these events had happened in Maryland or Virginia or Kansas, where you're not barred, it's okay for California to institute proceedings. But the only defense that you've come up with thus far for the extraterritoriality is that because you're a member of the District of Columbia Bar and the events occurred in the District of Columbia, the fact that California acted gives you a somewhat diminished opportunity to defend because you're defending against reciprocal rather than original jurisdiction in the District of Columbia.
Okay, so that's still not precisely what I'm saying, so I'm going to need to apologize. I'm probably a little bit nervous, so I'll try to be a little clearer. The problem with California reaching extraterritorially in this case is exacerbated by the fact that I was licensed in another jurisdiction. I would not have actually been doing these acts in another jurisdiction if I wasn't licensed to practice law in those other jurisdictions. But backing up for a second, I wouldn't have been practicing law, I wouldn't have been in a legal partnership, I wouldn't have been doing that in Washington, D.C. But backing up for a second to the broader question about what if this had happened in another state where I wasn't licensed to practice law, for instance. Okay. So if I'd gone out and entered into a contract in Maryland, and it was a business partnership, and I had nothing to do with law, and I wasn't practicing law in Maryland, okay, and something happened, let's say it was a breach of fiduciary duty judgment against me, or somebody claimed I didn't tell them something, do something, both in a summary judgment. And then people in California pointed to the contract that I had made and said, well, it was against public policy, you shouldn't have done that in Maryland. Well, the question is, could the California State Bar punish me for what had happened in Maryland? And according to the U.S. Supreme Court, the case that I cited in my brief, they can't. They can't.
But they could if it was a criminal case.
I am not saying that I know with any degree of certainty whether or not, if ever challenged, their ability to discipline an attorney would stand muster, constitutional muster. But what I am saying, by contrast, is that there's actually state law on the book in California that says that in the event of a criminal conviction anywhere, that they will do A, B, C, and D, and that includes, stripping the law license. So, there's actually a law, not 6106. 6106 is, people argue about this, and there's been some challenges. I don't think anyone's taken up the distance about, what is it? It's sort of vague, But that's not the issue today. The issue is they took a state statute. It's not the criminal conviction statute. It's a state statute about acts they consider improper or immoral or moral turpitude. It didn't say anything about, reaching outside of California. And they want to apply it to something that happened in Washington, D.C. That's the issue. right? Like, there's the big issue, and then there's the smaller issue. I'm trying to bring the court back to what I think is, you know, I'm not here to make large pronouncements about what I think the law should be. I'm just saying I know what happened. I know the consequences of this situation. The consequences are, I don't have to go to the district court of court appeals that has said unequivocally in numerous case laws that, hey, we control lawyers in this jurisdiction. We admit lawyers, discipline lawyers. We say what can and can't be done in this jurisdiction. And on top of that, it happens to be federal jurisdiction as well, which is my supremacy clause argument. And California doesn't care. They ran over that. They ran over that geographical limitation because somebody filed charges. Some administrative person decided to make a decision to file charges in the State Bar of California. I'm one of thousands of attorneys that they go through every year, thousands. And once you're in, there's no getting out. They don't, you know, it's less than 0.1%. So the problem is, once they made this decision, I would argue that it didn't really matter what I said, no matter how many times I tried to express the constitutional arguments, the federal problems, the jurisdictional problems, they just hold to it. In fact, they don't address any of the federal jurisdictional issues, not the jurisdictional issues, say, but any of the federal constitutional issues all the way through. You know, they just don't do it. So,
okay. Let me move on to another point. Thank you for clarifying your position on that one. In the declaration you filed, you said on page 7 that the State Bar of California proceedings were contrary to prior factual findings by the federal district court. It's imagine the declaratory action that you filed. And I was wanting to clarify in what way the State Bar proceedings were contrary to the prior factual findings.
Yes, thank you. So, by the way, preliminarily, the federal case that's pending before Judge Donato, that case also, he may have to recuse himself. That's another issue. But any case that's pending in the Northern District of California that I have incorporated, it's actually, the court had made a comment in one of its show clauses that it was collateral. It was actually filed before those proceedings were final, because I wasn't going to wait until they were final, because otherwise there's a Rooker-Feldman problem. I basically had to make the decision either to try to stop the continued deprivation of constitutional rights or forfeit that opportunity because of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. But so the issue there is an issue which I challenged both in the State Bar itself and the hearing department, which is the first level of the review department, and I even brought it up in my briefs in the California Supreme Court, although I denied my petition. So the issue is the body of evidence that State Bar has based its decision on is a civil proceedings, and it's a civil proceedings in Washington, D.C. that commenced in 2009 and ended in approximately, depending on how you measure it, 2011, and although there was additional, it dragged on with ancillary proceedings. This was the proceeding before Judge Honorable Judge Longenfeld, which I refer to as Robertson 1, as the civil trial between myself and William Cartenhauer, who was the partner in his partnership. So, William Cartenhauer had filed a complaint, then he filed an amended complaint. The original complaint was verified, and the complaint was not. And he listed a number of counts that included fraud, included negligent misrepresentation, acts of misappropriation, acts of misrepresentations, and counts related to the partnership and the management of the partnership. So he made all these allegations. So when Judge Fuvel took this to a trial before a federal jury in Washington, D.C., she reserved some of the counts for herself to decide in equity. And she allowed other counts to go to the jury. And there were special interrogatories with specific questions that were sent to the jury. And the jury was given the opportunity to find whether or not there had been fraud. And at the time, the issue had to do with a particular date, because that was the date and the timeline of events at which Mr. Cartenhauer had signed both an attestation, a sworn attestation before a public notary, where he said there had never been any attorney-client relationship, and the date at which he also executed a release agreement saying he was never going to sue me. Now, when the results came back, the jury could have found fraud. They could have found that. And the jury questionnaire, the interrogatories that the jury answered were very broad. They specifically asked about things such as the status of the Credit Suisse litigation, which you may be familiar with, you may not. It's one of the facts of it. It's whether or not I told Mr. Kartenhauer about what had happened with the security case that I was working on. It was part of the partnership we were involved in. Whether or not he was.
Do you have those interrogatories?
I do, and I can be happy to provide them if you want.
Those are not part of what you
have. They're in the record. They are exhibits. They are in the State Bar record, but if you would allow me to, tonight or tomorrow morning, I could file supplemental.
I would like to see those interrogatories. Yes. That would be very helpful.
So what happened was, you know, they saw this, and the questions included both whether or not Mr. Kartenhauer, had there been any, misrepresentations or failure to inform Mr. Kartenhauer about what had happened with the litigation, the Credit Suisse litigation, but also about the finances, about the loans, the promissory notes, because this was part of the way the partnership was structured, and I put the partnership documents in exhibits. They're in volume 3. I put them there at the top, so you can see the as exhibits of what we had signed, what we agreed to. And then the jury said no. So we get to after the verdict, prior to the judgment, Mr. Kartenhauer's attorney specifically asked Judge Ruvell, to enter, judgment on Mr. Kartenhauer's behalf for fraud, rescission of the contracts based upon registry fraud, all of
that. I read that.
And she says no.
I read that excerpt that you have here.
She says no.
Response.
And then she entered
this to rescission.
Yeah, but she says no. So she's not going to enter all that. And she enters a judgment in which she actually dismisses with prejudice all of those counts from Mr. Kartenhauer that include fraud, the misrepresentation, and many of those counts included the alleged acts of misappropriation. So this is a final federal judgment by a sitting district court. The State Bar of California took the exact same body of evidence. Mr. Kartenhauer didn't even come to California. And they reached a completely different conclusion.
What was required for the jury to find in order for them to award punitive damages?
So the State Bar tried, the prosecutors wanted to hang they tried to manage themselves, their position towards finding culpability based upon the fact that they're doing punitive damages. And I raised the issue of punitive damages and I said, look at what the instructions say. Look at the instructions. What did the jury find? Because, it's a matter of law, especially about federal appellate law. You want to know what the jury found, you look to the jury instructions because they're controlling. And the jury instructions listed several possible bases for the jury to award punitive damages. And some of them were things such as, that I acted with malice or with things. I don't call them fraud, maybe things or bad things. But there was also some things such as just negligence. Okay, or something that was, would not rise to the level of moral turpitude. And during oral argument,
did you get these clips? The instructions also available in the record?
They are in the record. And the easiest thing to do, if you allow me, is just to also to follow up so that my case for your staff attorney found that whether it will be in the record will be in the when the judge during the trial read the jury instructions to the jury, so it would be part of the trial transcript.
That's part of what's in this court.
It is. It's. Although I don't believe that I put it in, I'm pretty sure, Your Honor, that I did not put that in my own appendix, excerpts of records. But if I believe your staff attorney's looked at the entire record, it's there. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to.
Why don't you see if you're going to supplement?
So you want to see the jury instructions?
And the interrogatories. The jury interrogatories, the verdict.
Interrogatories also. So the interrogatories with respect to the no fraud found and also separately with respect to punitive damages.
Right.
Okay. So she dismisses all this. So the punitive damages, I walked away from it. Knowing that the jury had, in oral argument in the review department, when the prosecutor, if you look at the transcript of proceedings in the State Bar, at the review department level, when the prosecutor tried to raise that issue, now I'm just to paraphrase, I'm speaking off the top of my head. I don't have the transcript, but this is my recollection. But my recollection today is, this is studied recollections. I've looked at this issue before. I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain that you'll see that the judge herself, one of the review department judges, not the one who authored the opinion, but one of the other judges, basically stopped the prosecutor in that line of argument and said, but there's alternative grounds that are listed there. It wasn't that they found fraud, it was alternative grounds. So with respect to punitive damages, I didn't think that that would be something that they would be able to argue any kind of estoppel on or any kind of conclusive effect.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Was the state bar court bound by the jury's finding of no fraud, or was the state bar court entitled to look at the evidence and make a determination that what occurred there was, whether or not you call it fraud or not, sufficient to justify taking disciplinary action?
And this is a my answer is the best inference answer because the answer is actually complex. And I've looked at this issue before. The issue is whether or not they would be stopped. Okay, there's some issue preclusive effect or
equitable estoppel.
Yeah, it's some sort of equitable estoppel or issue preclusive effect. It could, you know, whether you submit it as collateral estoppel or res judicata, it's a little complicated. But the state bar has, within its own, this is not California Supreme Court of law, but it's within its own administrative body of rules, and it comes up with, they call these decisions, bar decisions from the review department. It's come out and said that it believes that, you know, that such findings are that they're required to give them great weight, but that they're not required to be bound by them. By contrast, and I do not have a citation for you today, but by contrast, I believe that the California Supreme Court has actually said, and this was an older opinion before the sort of the current status of the way things were, that there was more than just sort of they had some binding effect or some nearly binding effect. Now, okay, but what does federal law say? What's federal law say? And what makes this particularly apt in this case is not only that the findings themselves, but look at the order that came out, because it's a civil judgment. They've ordered restitution. They've never ordered restitution. I argued that in my appellate briefs, saying that, yeah, you can't do this. And basically, you retry the case, you reach a different result, and you've ordered restitution. Oh, by the way, the restitution you order is contrary to the restitution, to the civil judgment that the federal judge issued in Washington, D.C. She didn't award him interest, prejudgment interest. And on top of that, you're actually, and this is in the pending case, the current pending case for Judge Donato, and on top of that, you're awarding him $600,000, more than $10,000 of damages that he's already entitled, to, because he already paid that amount of money. So what happens here is you have what's equivalent of a civil judgment. And they can't do that. The law is clear. You can't interfere with a state court cannot interfere with an existing federal civil judgment. And that interference would also include a prohibition against retrying factual matters already determined by the federal court. So there you have it. There you have both issue preclusion and collateral estoppel.
So would that apply to you as well, that you couldn't argue that you weren't bound also by this findings of the district court and the District of Columbia?
So, you mean as a your okay. So I want to be clear, I understand the question, because I thought of two things when you asked that question. First, I thought, are you asking about offensive collateral estoppel, or are you asking me about whether or not I would be stuck with the finding that I breached a fiduciary duty?
Exactly. So if the jury found, so the jury did not find fraud on this special interrogatory, according to what you heard said today, and it's your position that equitably stopped the state bar from making the finding of fraud. So then my question is, if the jury found that you violated a fiduciary duty, does that similarly stop you from arguing that it was a violation of the fiduciary duty.
It would, except in one limited circumstance, which is applicable here. So, in Washington, the case that the Robertson won trial in Washington, D.C., the jurisdiction of the federal court was diversity jurisdiction because it had Mr. Carpenter and I from two different states, and it began as a claim filed in federal court on a state law contract. So, there is both under state law and actually under federal law as well, but it's, in this case, it's state law that would apply. There's a case, I believe, it's called Interdonato. You can find this, but it's a well-recognized principle of law, which is a judgment obtained by fraud on a court, I'm not talking about simple perjury, but a fraud on a court is voidable. And, or in some jurisdictions, it's actually considered void, but you've got to prove it was that's what happened. So in Washington, D.C., the controlling state law from the District Court, Court of Appeals says that judgments obtained by fraud in that jurisdiction are, based on state law, they're void. And there is federal law, which is also applicable, which basically gets you to the same result. So in this case, we have a case where, unbeknown to me, and unbeknown to I put a declaration of my trial attorney, is actually.
Okay, let me leave before you.
Sure,
I know what you're.
Okay, well, then,
the referring to,
sure,
is fraud and fraud to the paraclete, schizophrenia issue. But don't you have to go and attack the judgment Columbia to get it, if there was actually fraud on the court, don't you have to attack that judgment to establish that there was fraud on the court in order to make this
Sure. There's several aspects to that question that I want to try to miss, at least three that I've already thought of, so please interrupt me if it sounds like I'm off on a rabbit trail. The first is, why didn't I try, why did I wait? At the time, this is timely issue, I think, but it's always going to be, just of any course that asks, why did you wait so long? At the time, I thought Mr. Carpenter was senile. I thought he had Alzheimer's. I had no idea. I thought there was something wrong, age-related dementia. And if he got a civil judgment, given his age, given the way he looked at the trial, I put a picture of that in there so you could see it. I thought, you know what, what's the point? What's the point? You just let it go. You move on. I wouldn't have even found out about the fraud that had been for the California bar proceedings that forced me to go back and, try to figure out how I was going to defend myself. So then the question comes is, okay, do I have to go back to the District of Columbia? Well, in the federal action that I filed before Judge Donato, I fought that tooth and nail in Washington, D.C. I had a lawyer from Stanford Law Company that fought as well and got his reputation completely destroyed trying to defend me. Now we know what really happened. Well, we knew then something was wrong, and what happened at some point is that his attorneys had found out, and they got a pre-filing injunction that said that we couldn't actually bring any action at all. Not an action for fraud, but basically we weren't allowed to file any other pleadings in that jurisdiction related to the original case. Okay, and that was obtained by fraud as well. But the federal rules of civil procedure permit you to attack a fraudulent judgment using federal rule, either an independent action or part of federal civil procedure 60. This is a case that applies directly to this file as an independent action in the Northern District of California. Moreover, this judgment was registered in the Northern District of California. So this court here in San Francisco has jurisdiction over it. So it's not just a stretch. And there's different circuits that have come out in different ways. Like the 10th Circuit, for instance, says, you can challenge it anywhere.
California. It's part of your district court case that include a challenge to the validity of the district.
It does.
Be a judgment in Robertson 1.
It does. It does. And that's count 6. And, again, it's the people of California knew. They knew. They didn't know initially, but, once we got into it, I produced the evidence. And so the reason I say they knew is because they didn't deny it. And there's California state law that says once you've raised an issue like that in the California bar proceedings, if the state bar does not contest the issue, does not openly deny it, then they are, by law, viewed as having conceded it. So,
I don't know what they expected, but if they were going to try to use the fact of the Robertson 1 civil judgment against me as a basis for finding that I had committed some act of betrayal and misconduct, then I felt that it was appropriate, not because I have some desire to go back after Mr. Kartenhauer and chase him down, but I thought it was appropriate to have that judgment extinguished for fraud, such that there wouldn't be a factual basis at all for which the California Bar to point to explore its conclusions of misconduct.
Okay, thank you. So let me move on to another area of inquiry here. So, leaving aside all the jurisdictional questions about District of Columbia, let's just assume everything had occurred in California, okay, just for purposes of this hypothetical argument. So, why is the evidence that was presented, especially the evidence concerning the financial transactions on my client from WAR, account to the personal securities account, why is that evidence insufficient to support the bar's determination?
Okay, so it's not everything that happened, all of the partnership transactions, including the movement of money and the notices to Kartenhauer about what was happening on my side of the partnership, all that is documented and all that was equated to the partnership agreements themselves. And all of the agreements that are relevant, I put into volume 3 of the exhibits. You can read them, they're all there. In fact, one of them is something that he signed, which, you know, is which is where he basically acknowledges exactly what's going on at the time with the Credit Suisse litigation. So it's all there. So the movement of the funds was pursuant to the partnership agreements. And so there was nothing illegal about the movement of funds. The basis for the reason why the funds were moved in the first instance is actually explained in the very first partnership agreement, because we were not to leave them and that kind of account for tax reasons. So in other words, if I was the one who was going to be spending the money, I would move out to my own personal account, but I was liable to pay it back at some point. That's all in the documents. It's all there. But at the Roberts 1 trial, Mr. Kartenhauer said he just didn't understand anything because he didn't read any of the agreements that he signed, including the ones, you know, there were almost all of them were notarized, and some of them were, there was one that was a sworn document. I now know why that he said that. Now I understand what happened. At the time, again, I didn't know at the time. But the State Bar wants to ignore all of those agreements that have a signature on it that he signed, including ones
that he signed. Those are certainly agreements that seem to make a big difference to the California State Bar adjudicators. The partnership agreement said that the sole purpose of the partnership agreement was to provide legal services. And then Kartenhauer deposited millions of dollars into this account. That money ended up in your personal trading account, and you used it to trade securities. That didn't seem to the adjudicators to be provision of legal services. It seemed to them, I think, that you had taken this money from Kartenhauer, who was of a certain age, and used the millions of dollars to be put into this partnership account with you, the expectation that it would be used to fund the Lou security litigation, class action security litigation. But lo and behold, the money ends up in your personal account, and you use it for investment and trading. So, why is that not a violation of that partnership agreement and a violation of fiduciary responsibility, which is evidently what the District of Columbia jury found?
So, what the District of Columbia jury found was that there had been no misrepresentations to Mr. Kartenhauer about the loans. So, if you look through the review department's
list, what did they find? What was the basis for their finding of liability?
There's no special arbitration agency.
Well, they must have found that you did something wrong.
I did. They found that it was equitable. The jury believed at that time that looking at Mr. Kartenhauer in the jury box, or not the jury, in the witness box, dressed as he appears in one of the pictures I provided to you, telling the jury, hey, you know, here I am, some Stanford lawyer, telling them that he trusted me like a son, he never understood anything that was going on, he never read any documents, and, you know, he threw my all his money, blah, blah, blah.
I don't have a card now. I'm just sitting here. I'm trying to understand how you could take that money and trade individually and how that was consistent in concert with the terms of the partnership agreement or what would be the reasonable expectation of me if I was your partner and I'd given you millions of dollars for a class action security litigation. Only to find out that you take it alone to yourself and then use it for your personal training.
Okay, so there's three issues. One is, did Mr. Kartenhauer know about it? Did he prove it? Number two, were the funds that I took, were they used, were none of them at all used for my work on the Credit Suisse of the Lou litigation? And that's true, I'm sorry. But let's start with first. So, if we had signed an agreement, when you look at that particular provision agreement, you also got to look at the agreement that precedes it, which governs the entire partnership as well, which is the September 16, 2004 agreement, where we talk about the partners that draw the money out as loans and it was for tax purposes and they will be responsible for it. So everything has to be paid.
Wait.
So everything has to be paid back at some point.
But you took this money out and you used it for your personal training.
Well, that's not accurate either, because what I did is I took it out of the investment accounts and then I took a loss in the investment accounts. Right?
But you had control of the funds and you make the investment decisions. This is no longer the WAR partnership. This is the Robertson training account.
Okay. So now, if you were Mr. Kartenhauer and you were informed about this and you told me to do this, then how does that change the calculus? Because that's exactly what happened. You see, if you look at the review department decision, they want to base it upon what Mr. Kartenhauer didn't know, what he wasn't told, what wasn't said to him. Okay, but those statements, first of all, he wasn't in California, so they don't know. They're basing it upon what he said there in Robertson transcripts.
So how do you establish that he knew this? Based upon what the findings were in the District of Columbia determination and the fact finding and evidence determination in the state bar court versus state bar proceedings in California.
Well, no, those are two very different things. So, in the state bar proceedings, if you look at the transcripts, I testified about all of this stuff.
Yeah, but they didn't believe you.
It doesn't, okay. But what does that mean? They didn't believe me, so I'm testifying.
Once you lost the relationship.
If Judge Uvella thought that was true, then she certainly would have used her equitable powers in her judgment for fraud, misrepresentation, misappropriation. Okay? Because what you seem to be suggesting to me is that maybe there's some, the way this money was handled was not proper. But she didn't think so. That's not what her judgment said.
Well, the jury found that.
The jury found that, but she refused to enter. And
she said, I'm not going to rescind the contract based upon the jury verdict.
But she also just
that's not it. The same as the jury finding that imposed $3.5 million in general damages and $3.5 million in punitive damages.
Right. But she also dismissed those claims of Mr. Kartenhauer. Now, to understand what was happening with the loans, you also have to understand that I put this as one of the exhibits as well. Is that there was a timeline, okay? This is a timeline of investments, and you have to understand what Mr. Kartenhauer in these exhibits, there's a civil judgment from Santa Clara Superior Court here for $3.8 million that I obtained against Mr. Kartenhauer.
It was vacated. The default judgment
was vacated. So the judge in Santa Clara, after this happened up here, and they were claiming, where the money goes, look, Here's the accounting for the partnership. Here's the ledgers. These loans were taken out commensurate with work that was being done.
Was there an answer filed to your complaint in that action?
No, still no answer.
Okay. Mr. Carson, so it's a default based upon your facts, right?
Based upon, yeah, that's correct.
Your complaint with your facts, right?
system that was approved up here.
Never tested by the defendant, right? No answer.
That's correct.
Answer default, and then the default judgment was vacated when they came in and said, I don't even know what ground. You don't discuss that with ground. I haven't looked into what ground this. I don't know if it's jurisdiction or whatever. But this judgment is, in my view, that judgment is nothing. It doesn't establish anything. It's been vacated. It hasn't been tested.
So the only reason I put it in there was to try to provide some additional color to show that, according to the, because this judge actually looked at the, looked at the big county. If you look at Robertson 1, what happened was that because I only filed a declaratory judgment action, I was never allowed to put any of the proof of the contributions that I had made according to the partnership contracts, which offset the loans. Okay? So, and she that's a ruling that she had in there. She said that, I'm not going to allow you to present the evidence and set off. You'll have to bring it separately.
Okay, let me move on to another issue, and this is back to due process a little bit. You are attacking the proceeding because the state bar proceedings denied you the opportunity to take some depositions, five depositions that you wanted, that you were not allowed to take.
They didn't allow me any witness testimony, both the requested deposition testimony and the notices to appear.
I'm addressing the tariff issues right now. So I know who John Watts and Stanley Slater are, and I know who Tim Steele is. Could you remind me who Philip O'Donoghue is and who Robert Grant is, what value their depositions would have had?
So after the Robertson 1 judgment was there, Judge Duvall in Washington, D.C., she had already raised it. Sort of briefly and evidently about, Carthouse's appearance, what he looked like, and some issues. She was just concerned. She was concerned. It didn't look like something that looked right to her. By the time the judgment was entered, his attorneys wanted to get money paid out of the registry that Judge Duvall was holding money from me to satisfy part of the judgment. And she didn't want to do it because she didn't think he was competent. So she set up, I'm not saying anything about whether or not this was proper for her to do. I'm just simply saying this is what she did. She set up, she had two Maryland attorneys, which are those two attorneys, Philip O'Donoghue and Robert Grant. She had some direct contact with them. They were in Maryland. And she asked them, some state's work and some other types of things. And she asked them to interview Mr. Carthauer, look at some of his records, and report back to her directly on an ex parte basis whether or not there was any grounds, to basically sort of order some kind of guardian ad litem. Okay? So I didn't know. I was never apprised of what went down at this hearing. I was just meeting. This was always kept in the dark about it. Apparently, as it turned out, Mr. Kernhauer's attorney, his trial attorney, Mr. Kearney, was there. And he was the only state bar witness. He was the only live witness that showed up in California at the state bar proceedings. At that time, he still thought his firm was going to get money from the California bar. So, in the course of cross-examining him, I found out through her memorandums, which is, I don't know if you saw that, volume 3, exhibits Y3 and X3. Okay, so I put the transcript to excerpts where she's saying this is what she's going to do with it, the memorandum that followed. So she mentioned those names in her memorandum, where she decided, based upon the representations of Mr. Kernhauer's attorney, that he was okay. And the report that she got back from these attorneys in Maryland, this ex parte, that it was okay for her to go ahead and release. There was not any grounds that she was going to release the money.
And so concerned, just so that I understand, her concern was whether Carthauer was competent to agree to pay fees to Kearney.
I, well, I put the transcript of 6 excerpts on there so you can see it for yourself. I mean, my recollection is it was, look, she didn't think he was competent. Now, we could try to narrow it down and say, well, you know, the problem is if she comes out and she says, he's not competent, then she couldn't allow him to testify at the trial against me. It's a problem because he's just testified at the trial because all along his attorneys have told the court he's competent. And, of course, none of the stuff about the schizophrenia has come out. None of that stuff. So, and he looks, you know, you listen to him, he's like, he seems odd, but, you know, he seems lucid. That's what paranoid schizophrenia is. So she can't say that he's not legally competent, but she doesn't want to give him the money because she says, at a minimum, he's not competent to handle his finances. So she sits it out. So apparently, I cross-examined Mr. Kearney about this during the bar proceedings, and I find out what I suspected all along was that something was said, but I don't know if it ever got back to the judge, and I doubt that it did, because if she did, she would have taken action. So something was said during that meeting. You know, he wants to admit that schizophrenia was mentioned, but he won't say it wasn't mentioned. He says it's possible, which means, and there was also apparently some communication that happened. So that's why I wanted to depose him to find out, well, what do we really know? What happened? Was this guy, you know, was this guy confident when he testified during Robertson 1? Is there some undisclosed information? So that's,
and bottom line is that after consulting with O'Donohue and Grant, the judge concluded that he was competent enough for releasing funds to Kearney.
That's right. If you read count 6 in the pending Northern District California case that I filed before Judge Nava right now, I lay out.
And you want to depose once. Testify, or did you have any deposition entered into evidence in the D.C. proceeding concerning Watts?
They took, ultimately, they took his, they admitted deposition trial testimony from him.
And that had to do with your involvement in the
litigation of Kearney's 60 case.
And what about Slater?
So they had a limited trial deposition, short trial deposition that they admitted. But Dr. Slater never disclosed there were direct questions that were asked that he should have probably answered more fully that would have led to the discovery of the schizophrenia. He never disclosed it on the record. And in fact, as I said, looked at pending actually Judge Nava, what we found subsequently was that, you know, Mr. Carnauer's attorneys had removed records from the batch of records that were produced pursuant to a federal subpoena from Dr. Slater. I don't know whether Dr. Slater knew that or didn't know that. We don't know. I wanted to find out. Of course, this goes to two things. One is, you know, what really happened with the schizophrenia? When was he lucid? He wasn't lucid, apparently, in 2005 and 2006. He had these episodes, and yet he testified about those episodes at the Robertson 1 trial. And then number two, it goes to the issue of fraud on the federal court. The fact that not only did these attorneys give Mr. Carnauer to perjuriously testify in such a way to conceal this from the court, they also tampered with the subpoena production of the medical records, which led us to that same result. I mean, if we had known that, I mean, if anyone had known that, that would have been a game changer. We certainly wouldn't have allowed him to testify, or we would have had, you know, experts come in to find out if he was even lucid at the time. So that's why I wanted to depose Dr. Slater. That's why I wanted to depose Uncle O'Donohue and Robert Grant. By the time I requested those depositions, I already had enough evidence to suspect that's what had happened, and that was the basis. But they denied me all that.
What evidentiary value would you have? Could you have derived from deposing Judge Teel?
So Judge Teel, there was two things. One is, and I got, Judge, he's angry at you. You just got to shut up and let it go. He just got to do it. It's just, you know, there's no point. And Judge Teel was angry at me and another attorney because, as I read the opinion, he felt that the arguments we made in bankruptcy court at the heart were designed to elongate the collection process. Mr. Carnauer on his judgment, we felt like that's the way I perceived it. And I wanted to oppose Judge Teel for two reasons. One is because I thought that Judge Teel knew that the Robertson judgment had been fraud. There was evidence that the Robertson judgment had been procured by fraud, and that Mr. Carpenter's testimony had been false, or that he had been incompetent when he testified. I thought that would have had a profound effect on Judge Steele's opinion about what it went down. I thought he might have even done something against McCarthy. That's what I thought. And secondly, when I cross examined Mr. Kearney, who again was the only witness that showed up to testify for bar, I solicited admission from Mr. Kearney that the arguments that we had made, the legal arguments that we had made to Judge Teal, were consistent with the bankruptcy treatise that one of Mr. Cartenhauer's other attorneys had actually authored. So we had, Judge Teal said we made frivolous arguments. The arguments came straight out of a legal treatise textbook. So
what would the deposition of Judge Teal be? You make that legal argument without taking his deposition.
Well, nobody wants to. Let's be clear. I cannot imagine an attorney would ever want to have to depose a bankruptcy judge or any judge. But if the bar was going to use the sanctions memorandum as a basis to say that I abused the process, and I wanted to be able to introduce evidence from the author of the memorandum that said that, I wasn't completely aware of this, maybe it wasn't, you can't really take what I wrote at face value because it was obviously under a certain circumstances.
If you would do that without you filing some kind of a motion to amend the judgment?
Well, I can't. I don't know what he would do. I would think that any judge would be absolutely outraged if they found out that they had relied upon a judgment and testimony. But by the way, this is the same courthouse. This is the same court. It's not like across the street. He's on the second floor, and the trial court's on the district judge's on the third floor. So I thought he would have been outraged at it. So he could have done something sua sponte. He could have issued his own sua sponte show cause order, or he could have invited me to, give me permission to file something. It could have
been serving him with the judge's issue notice. You have confidence to do that.
I had no other choice. The bar wanted to use as their evidence the memorandum, the sanctions memorandum, and I told them, I quoted the case in the controlling case law in Washington, D.C., from that same district court that said, sanctions memorandum do not have that evidentiary value. I'm sorry. They don't. There's a reason they don't. That's the court. So I got sanctioned
by it. Just speaking as a person who's involved in the judicial process and have been for 23 years, it would horrify me for somebody to try and impose it and say, what do you think you would have decided in that case? My answer would probably be, I think it's just a hypothetical question. I can't answer that question without knowing everything.
I don't think that. That was the greatest respect. I understand. I completely concur that's not really the way it's supposed to happen. But with respect to that issue, I would say that the deposition that would have never gone into his mental thinking in that manner. That's not what the deposition would have been about. The deposition.
What would you have explored?
Well, if the factual findings that the memorandum was based upon were different because it was fraud, then that would have been what I would have brought out.
Let me move on to the next question I have. So you were involved early on in this new class action litigation, yes? Were you one of the first people to work on it?
It's a long time ago. I was involved with it.
How did it originate? How did your involvement and how did this case originate against Credit Suisse?
There was class action suit. Okay, so
what was the basis for the class action?
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's this is a broad question. I can start just talking.
Let me just ask this. What is the gravamen of the complaint in the class action?
Okay. The gravamen of the complaint in the class action was that there were tech companies that had been at Tech Mobile Plus. You've been here a while.
Yes.
You remember what happened here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Did the Tech Mobile Plus There was a bunch of fraud that emerged. There was allegations of fraud. There was actually the biggest case was the NRA IPO case. It was led by the Wilbur Weiss firm, which ended up, you know, there was all across the country thousands of cases that were filed. You know, as you securities fraud, NASDAQ collapsed, you know, people lost money. The roads in the Bay Area suddenly got, you know, kind of drivable. People moved because they couldn't afford, you know, they had no jobs. So, all of these cases, we're trying to figure out who's fraud. Elliott Spitzer filed an investigation out of Manhattan. The Securities Exchange had an investigation. The federal authority, the FBI, everybody had an investigation going on. So, most of the cases, all the cases that were related in any way, got MDL transferred. It all ended up, there was a couple of sittings for the MDL panel, but the one that we sat through was actually, I think, somewhere up in the Northeast. I want to say it was, it might have been Delaware, I'm not sure. But, so that all got transferred to Southern District of New York, Manhattan. And there was mostly cases were piggyback cases based upon the IPO process itself, what happened. Just in the IPO process, this idea that there was an inflated pop that the stock didn't do what it would have naturally done otherwise.
So, did you have a client you were representing?
We had clients we were representing.
Who's the lead?
Well, so Charles, there was another attorney that filed the case initially, and then I joined.
So, you had clients you were representing?
At some point, we began to get a group of clients together.
Okay.
And
you represented them? So
you understand that there was multiple attorneys involved here, so to some extent, all the attorneys were representing these clients.
Right.
Okay.
So
the Armamon was what happened after the pop. It was that, you know, the blue case was a little bit different because, in addition to alleging that there was this artificial pop on the IPO, that what happened in the 6 months after the IPO was actually. Had been fraudulently engineered to produce upside surprises in the earnings announcements of each one of the companies based upon the forecast, the estimates of the forecast at the time of the IPO.
This is Credit Suisse who allegedly was responsible for the financial forecasting?
That's correct. I don't remember the exact details. This was 2004.
So why didn't you appear in the case? Because I noticed that they talked about you kind of working behind the scenes, like in the litigation. Why was it your name, one of the counsel? Watch was one of the counsel, right? Why was your name part of it? Why didn't you have an appearance?
So there were several reasons for that, and some of them are confidential, but I'm happy to disclose ones that aren't confidential to you. On the record right now, one of them, I've stated this already in the State Bar proceedings. One is that we weren't sure the state of law was in flux and securities laws were changing, and there was changing happening right then and there because all these claims were hitting, these sort of, you know, multi-billion dollar claims. So we wanted to be able to pursue the claims, but if we had filed in one jurisdiction or another jurisdiction or got an MDL transfer, literally the circuit law in different jurisdictions was different about what was, you know, the requirements for pleading and proving securities class actions and 75 class actions. It's not simple. It's not like a slip and fall case. You know, you've got all these elements, and, you know, well, whether or not you adequately pled an element. In the Ninth Circuit, for instance, now that anyhow, so the reason for doing it was, number one, at that time, we were gathering, my recollection is we were gathering together a large group of class representatives, okay, and for each of the various subclasses. And we wanted to have, number one, John Mr. Watts, had experience in class actions already as a class action. You know, he'd actually appeared in court in various class actions, so there's no question that the court would find that he was competent to handle the class action. And then number two, we wanted to backdrop the insurance policy that, based upon we had studied the law at that time, and we had studied the law, we wanted the insurance policy that said that if for some reason we were to fail on the pleadings without actually getting to class certification,
into, you know, Maris's termination, that we could cure the previous error and bring class claims again in a reformatted manner, which at that time was allowable, and certain law that we had studied said it could be done. And as long as the case did not reach certification and the dismissal on the merits, then, you know, if it was dismissed, and, you know, for instance, for pleading deficiencies, which is what happened with the Cthulhu case, the Cthulhu Space case, then other, not the same class plaintiffs, but again, we had, by this time, we had a large group.
The way that we can have is this effect for ability or non-ability to make an appearance in the case.
I could have made an appearance, but John could not have made the appearance as lead counsel a second time in a new case. And that was the reason we put
him forward. Well, why were you co-counsel?
Well, I would have been co-counsel if we got to, if the pleadings had survived, if you had the 12B6. So in securities class actions, this is, you know, sort of the way things work. And there's always, always the word. The overwhelming pattern of the way these things proceed is there's a 12B6 motion. In fact, there's a statutory stay while that, discovery stay while the 12B6 motion is adjudicated. Is there sufficient allegations of the fraud to allow, as a matter of law, to allow the claim to proceed? If you pass the 12B6 motion, or the, you know, motion on the pleadings that demurred, then at that point, then you move from certification, and then you, you know, you're into discovery, and then you're moving towards trial. So the plan was get it through any pleadings attacks. If you get certified at that juncture, then that's the case we're going to run with. And then all of the attorneys would have gone on a record. There was other attorneys that had actually been working with as well, gone on a record as part of counsel of record in that particular action. It was, you know, when you're dealing, these were, I kid you not, there was a, it's in the record in terms of what the size of the IPO litigation. The IPO litigation itself, at one point, they had a $1 billion guarantee first tranche settlement after having passed the 12B6 mark, which meant that at the time, and it all fell apart eventually in the Court of Appeals for various reasons had to do with some classification, but at the time, and this is when I'm actually involved, and Mr. Cardenhauer is actually involved, if you pass, they were the case we were coordinated with, we were the only case in the country that survived. It got to be a standalone case, we were connected to them from the same judge. They go through the motion to dismiss, they survive 12B6, there's a $1 billion guarantee from the first tranche of settlement defendants, in which case, you know, all they've got to do is keep going, get through certification, and even if they lose the case, they're still going to collect $1 billion, and that will be distributed to the attorneys and to the class plaintiffs. So,
you have some good questions.
We're thinking as strategically as possible at this juncture, you know, by all the ways that the case can proceed.
So the State Bar moved to use video and transcripts from Marcus Moon.
That's correct.
And they were granted leave to do so, to some extent at least. Did you seek to use similar materials from Robert's Moon to introduce in the State Bar proceedings? Video or transcripts?
Yes, there were transcript excerpts from Robertson 1 for some of the witnesses that testified in Robertson 1, Ray Conley, Adrian Blue. These were people that testified, they're not in my record excerpts, but they're part of the State Bar record. These people that testified that they had mailed Mr. Cardenhauer copies of documents, copies of the promissory notes, copies of the pleadings, things that were going on, and the litigation. And, you know, Mr. Cardenhauer said at trial that he didn't remember getting them, and, you know, he got letters, so he didn't know if he read them, and just kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't have any further questions. This is not really my brand. It's not quite what I expected, John. But the issue of the transcripts, you know, let me start with that. Okay. So, number one,
the state law that they used to introduce the transcripts in California bar proceedings actually says that they're not allowed to issue to enter, they're not allowed to use those transcripts unless that person can be compelled to appear before the whole board. This was an objection I raised in the bar proceedings. It says, look, you can't do it. Your own rule says you can't do it. That's right, it has to be available. Now, but it's a poorly crafted statute. It's a statute, actually, it's part of the California Business Professions Code. It's poorly crafted, but it says that, you know, this is, if you look at some of my arguments, my review department brief and things like that, I argue, you violate your own rules by doing this. Your rules say you can't do it. Yeah, whatever it is. So, you know, I argue that, but there was a bigger issue there. You know, even if you were not going to agree with, you know, that they what they done was improper by their own, by California law, their own rules, the bigger issue was, you're going to use transcripts and you're not going to allow me the opportunity to impeach that person that maybe the prior testimony was false.
But you had an opportunity to cross-examine and impeach in Robert's court, right?
That's just the point. So you might say, well, but you know, what about the, did you have an opportunity back then? Well, you know, a full and fair opportunity, implies that there's no fraud and no perjury. So, we know that there was perjury. We now have it. It's in the record. We know there's perjury and we know there was fraud.
Yeah, hold on.
So,
but that's a separate point.
It's due process.
But you're pulling the overlay fraud on this. Let's say we decide for a moment that there was fraud. Assuming that there was no fraud, if that had been the proceedings and that there was no basis to attack it, does your argument still have weight that there was an issue in allowing them to utilize this deposition?
I don't argue because I've argued it a certain way based upon the facts. Because I think I'm right about the facts. I think this denial of opportunity to cross-examine in terms of, you can use the word confront, although if you use the word confront, then it almost invokes the Sixth Amendment, right to confrontation. Criminal proceedings are essentially quasi-criminal. Some jurisdictions say it applies, others don't. But, you know, regardless of which words you use, confront, examine, cross-examine, he's an adverse witness. And I have the audit. Due process requires, if they're going to use that testimony, that be given. It's not a civil proceeding.
He's unavailable.
No one ever said he was unavailable. No one ever said he was unavailable. There's no finding that he was unavailable.
Is it that way it's required?
No one ever said he was unavailable. They just said they didn't get an answer. They just didn't want to bring him. They didn't want to make him. You know what they could have let you
do? He's in D.C., right?
He's in Maryland.
So they can't compel him to do it, right?
That's right. Of course, you know, if they wanted to use his testimony, then bar prosecutors could have said they could request a trial deposition, just like I requested trial depositions of my five fact witnesses, and, you know, I probably would have
used that. But they already had this transcript testimony that had been admitted, subject to your cross-examination in the proceeding.
Number one, claims are different. Okay? Claims and allegations are claims are different, right? So they are different. They're different. But if you look at
how are they different?
Well,
is it the whole point that the California bar proceedings were based upon, is in part the evidence for the DPDC proceeding?
Evidence from the D.C. proceeding is one thing, but testimony by Mr. Cartenhauer in Washington, D.C., using civil transcripts and a crazy criminal proceeding, number one.
Evidence.
It may be evidence, but, if I've objected, I've demanded an opportunity to examine, cross-examine by his prior testimony, the due process says I'm entitled to it. And they could have provided it, but they didn't. They could have produced him. I served notices to appear, and they didn't produce him. They didn't say that they were going to use the transcripts of the first day of the trial. if they had known in advance, you know, that they weren't going to produce them, they could have gone to trial, they could have asked for a compelled deposition, in which I would have had an opportunity to either object, or, you know, at least object, or I could have said, sure, let's do it, and we could have got his testimony. The issue of due process is actually, I've outlined for the court, you know, you've got the federal constitutional standards. Well, let's remember that in the last section of my legal memorandum, I also talk about, you know, what about the California law, the California rules, and do they just not follow their own rules? Well, you know, not according to the Supreme Court, not according to the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit says, you know what? If you say that these are the rules that are going to apply, then the accused has a due process right to have those rules followed. And if you just look at the, you know, you look at the rules that they lay out, I mean, you know, to examine across the witnesses, your own rules, you know, this is Business and Professions Code 6085, and also, you know, the rules and procedures of the State Bar of California, the ones that were in effect at that time, Rule 5.41. You know, they didn't allow me these rights. Before I forget, I need to mention that there is a factual issue that I want to raise to the court and also the staff attorney. So when you look at the September 4th, 2013 decision by the first administrative hearing officer, this would be in the hearing department, her name is Judge Alicia Armenteras. She, in her memorandum, she made a mistake. I think it's a typographical error, but, you know, it's also possible that it was...
It's September 4th, 2013.
That's correct.
I also have it right here.
Right. Yeah, I do not, but I can tell you where it is. If you look on, there should be something on the first page. I believe it's going to be where she talks about the introduction of the, where the bar moved to change, to amend the notice of disciplinary charges.
The first page.
It's either the first or the second page, where she mentions that she granted their motion to amend the notice of disciplinary charges. This is one of the first couple pages where she denies my motion to dismiss based on
the motion to amend the notice of disciplinary charges to conform to the rules.
So it was pointed out to me yesterday that in that memorandum, doesn't she say that they filed the motion to amend on the first day of trial?
On May 28th.
Oh, it does?
Prior to the commencement of the trial, the state bar filed a motion to amend the notice of disciplinary charges to conform to proof.
That's a typographical error, or it's a misunderstanding on her part. That's not what the record says. They filed it on the last day of the trial after the evidence. May 28th was actually...
That's what the video defines.
I don't know, but someone pointed that out to me yesterday.
Has corrected. Why shouldn't the state bar have been allowed to amend the notice of disciplinary charges based on the proof?
Okay. So, the amendments that they requested, I challenge that as I challenged the notice element of due process. I challenged it on two bases. One was saying that I had no notice that they were expected to be called out on System 106. The second was that by omitting the NDC in the way they did, they had deprived me of notice of what the charges were prior to that I was going to be defending this. So,
did you oppose that motion to make these points?
I did.
And was there any recent decision on that, or is it just it was granted?
No, it was you saw it was.
I raised that to the review department.
I did. I raised it all the way through, including in my petition for review. So, the way I understood that, I had also, and this is mentioned in my recitation of facts in my legal memorandum, I had challenged. Initially, the form of the allegations being duplicative and also being unclear in many ways. And that was summarily denied with an explanation. But when I went to trial, my understanding is trying to parse the allegations against me as to what was this scheme to defraud and what was the misrepresentations and what was this misappropriation. my understanding, I had other people look at it because I was like, okay, you know, because I got to prepare, I got to go on my own exhibit list. What exactly am I trying to prove here? Because it's my reading, my understanding was what they were accusing me of was basically they created a phony partnership in which I told Mr. Kartenhauer if he came in and invested money and worked for me in this partnership, I was going to work on this large series of class action lawsuit, when in fact that was not true, that was all a sham. So I was taking money based upon something I told him I was going to do, and working on this litigation is going to be successful and they're going to make a lot of money, but that was all false. That's the way I read the allegation. In fact, if you look at them, I mean, it's, there's a number, they said I never had anything to do with litigation, I never had anything to do with John Watts, that was, I was misrepresenting things to Mr. Kartenhauer because I had no working relationship whatsoever with John Watts. Okay, I get it. That's the scheme to defraud. Okay, and that's the misrepresentations they're talking about. And misappropriation, again, not clear. They're like, well, then, if I take money from him, then there's another thing that I'm obviously misappropriating, although I would have used a different word. So, when they amend the NDC, I was able to elicit, in the course of the bar trial from the state bar's only witness, Patrick Kearney, I had found in the discovery, I had found a series of emails where Mr. Kearney had told the state bar prosecutors had drafted the allegations that wasn't true. That in fact, I had been involved with the Credit Suisse litigation, but they didn't change the allegations. They would have been involved in anyway, as is.
But those allegations also included misappropriation based upon the use of the funds for your personal training account.
I don't think that's what they said. I do not think that's what they said. My reading, I had other people look at it as well. My reading was the misappropriation was that I had, was this idea, was this phony partnership thing. And in fact, when they amended the NDC, I got Mr. Kearney to admit during the Barnes trial that he told the bar prosecutors this and they just haven't changed it. So then, the trial ends and our prosecutors file a very motion to amend the NDC. And you look at the paragraphs they amend, they take out that entire theory of culpability. They also removed the allegation of misappropriation within the factual body of the brief. So I thought what was going to happen when we got the hearing department decision was that she would have dropped that. I thought, okay, so she's going to drop counts 1, 3, 5, whatever it was, and what I'll be looking at is some sort of discipline based upon, she probably wants to continue to push based upon sanction memorandum from Judge Teal. But that's not what she did. So when we got to the review department, I brought this up. The review department issued the last reason memorandum. And I read it, and I said, wait a minute. I said, this idea of a sham partnership, are you referring back to the original NDC? I filed a motion for reconsideration. I mentioned this in my factual statement here. I said, you're looking at the wrong version of the NDC, because they amended it. They dropped that entire line of culpability. My point is that I think they amended the NDC in such a way that prejudiced me, and that was not what I was defending. That was not the principle that crossed the wrong thing. It's a trial. You can't do that. I told him, come on. So, I even argued with the review department. He said, there's a factual disconnect here between the amended version that you see what I was defending against, and what these findings that you're making. If you read the review department decision, if you read the hearing department decision, one thing that they don't do is they don't actually cite specific items in the record. They just say, here's our conclusions, here's our findings. Okay, so you're kind of stuck. But then again, that's not what the federal judge found either. So, this is all I can do. So I end up filing this federal lawsuit with Judge Nato saying, well, stop, you can't do this. Not like this.
All right. That's my questions. And if you want to take a few minutes to wrap up, that's fine. But you don't have to. I mean, all of the points. So far, you haven't said anything that I don't recall reading in your papers.
Your Honor's review is very limited, I understand. So the only question that I have to add that I'm the case that I have to make to you, if you're going to make your findings on, is whether or not I was deprived of constitutionally adequate due process, at least on present. And, you know, I have raised the issue that there couldn't be a violation of 6106 if nothing happened in California, which really goes to affirmative proof. So, you know, this is the only case that I could find in the history of the State Bar of California where they didn't allow, first of all, they did what they did extraterritorial reach. And then they didn't allow a person to present any of the requests of witnesses. It's also the only case that I found where they changed the NDC after the trial. So, you know, I think if I had to sort my arguments to you in my legal memorandum again, I was very tempted to put, you know, opportunity, due process opportunity is the first one, but, you know, I'm not sure how you're going to perceive it, so I listed them in the order that I'll list in other courts, which is starting off with the problem that I have. Now I've got to go to Washington, D.C., and I get less rights there to defend myself against the same charges because it was brought first here, and now all I get is reciprocal discipline there. That court may very well say, no, this is not going to allow that to happen. And say, you know, I'm not going to predict what the court's going to do. I'm saying that I'm making legal arguments that I think are sound. I think the rules provide in that jurisdiction that they can just say, no, we won't do that. What we will do, if we think there's a problem, is we'll refer it to our own board on how to do original disciplinary proceedings where you're entitled to the full panoply of rights that you should have had if it applied in the first instance.
So, is there any expected date for them to issue their determination? Have you had any kind of oral presentation there?
Not necessarily. My response to the show cause order was filed approximately 20 days ago, and disciplinary counsel in Washington, D.C. filed its statement, which was a very terse 15-page statement, which is only about 7 pages of actual analysis, which they were required to do. They filed that at the end of last week. I had to file a reply now, which I'm going to do in the next couple of days, and then I don't know what they'll do. And there was a delay to
guarantee a full argument.
There's no guarantee. They might. But I will tell you that the case before Judge Donato, which is, you know, still there, if I can't get a ruling from him in the near term, I'm going to follow Ruth Mandamus to the Ninth Circuit and raise the issue and say, you know, look, I mean, it's the basis for doing so is not, it's not because of disrespect for Judge Donato or for the district. The basis is, look, this was filed as a official capacity injunctive relief suit where the only relief sought, no seeking monetary damages from anybody, none of that, only seeking to halt what I believe the evidence shows is the deprivation of my basic constitutional rights, and separately to stop the re-litigation of an already settled federal civil judgment out of Washington, D.C. So, you know, either one is grounds, either one is irreparable injury, and if the Northern District is not going to move in an expedited fashion, they've had months now, and yet, look, here I am answering you. If they had granted the temporary restraining order that I requested, or they had granted, and they still haven't ruled on my preliminary injunction, then I wouldn't even be here because they would have stopped that process. The Supreme Court of California never would have issued a final order. So at this juncture, I can't just sit and wait. I did all that work. I think the case is strong. I just have to go with the writ. And I'll file a status report if you want to object. I'll just say I filed a writ. Here's the case number. If that's okay with you.
How much time do you need to submit these additional matters, the interrogatories?
Tomorrow. Close business tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow's fine. First of these, but once I receive them, I'll consider this matter submitted.
Okay.
The next step is for me to issue a report of recommendation about the proper disposition of the case here. That will be served on you. You'll have an opportunity to file your response, objections, and then that report and your objections are going to go to a 3-10 trial here.
It's just that much to do. Thank you, Your Honor. Is there any... Would there be a basis for you to was concluded it might be in the interest of the court to stay this matter for ease of the proceedings.
No.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for your presentation today. I'll wait. So one record question. In the default, in the judgment that you filed in the Superior Court that ultimately was vacated, the default judgment, in that case you submitted an accounting of hours spent that you on the litigation, right? Was that, were you able to present that evidence to the State Bar Court?
I did as well. I did, but I wasn't able to. If you look, it was Justice Miller ordered financial accounting at Robertson 1 for the partnership, and we have CPA locally in which the hours are tabulated.
And that's an exhibit in the state court, or where's it located?
It's trial exhibit in my appendix record excerpts. It's volume 3. Exhibit U, as in UFO 3, base number 940, and that's the December 31st, 2009 financial accounting for the partnership that was filed in Robertson 1. It was my bar trial exhibit O. So if you had to go to the bar, if you go to, trial exhibits, there would be bar O as in. Is it over? Oh, is it okay?
Thank you. So this matter will be submitted upon receipt of the supplemental materials
for preparation of the report.
Thank you.